We've been having some fun in this sermon series around a metaphor. It starts with the idea of to dance. Dancing has something to do with finding the delight of God in the deepest part of your spirit, the release and the experience of joy deep down inside. Unfortunately, it's often a delight that eludes us because of this next thing called scars. Scars, we said, are those things that mark a place of injury in our life. Only we've been not been talking about scars on the human frame. We've been talking about hurts and wounds that have been much deeper for us, deep within the human heart. A scar is evidence that something wounded you. Everybody has scars. If we would stop for a moment, go around the room, we could tell some incredible stories of painful places where we have visited in life. And for weeks, we've been saying that with every one of those scars, you have a story. Some human experience left a mark on your soul. Some of those hurts significantly shaped you. Some of those hurts have radically changed you. Some of those hurts still control you. And some of those hurts, even today, are restricting and threatening to steal God's greater future, which brings us back to the title of the series in the first place. Can you dance, even though life has brought you scars? Dancing with the scars. This series has a subtitle. It's actually the trigger for those who long to dance again. Dancing with the scars - total forgiveness. We began a few weeks ago attempting to define what total forgiveness would look like. Such an incredible thing, such an awkward piece. What would it even look like if we were trying to understand it? And from there, in the second week, we posed a question, an important question. What happens when we don't forgive? Now, those teachings are available online if you wanted to review or look at those again if you missed those. But here in week three today, we're going to attempt to answer another question. How can I know when I have forgiven someone, totally? See, forgiveness is very complex. Complicated, in fact, is describing it just isn't enough. It's not fitting that we would just simply have some instructions where part A goes into part B, into slot C. It's not that easy. There are some things you really have to see before you could understand what it was. Something so dynamic that if you could see it, then you would have this aha moment where you'd say, oh, that's what that looks like. Would you like to see what forgiveness looks like on a 39-year-old man? Then Joseph could no longer control himself before all his attendants, and he cried out, "Have everyone leave my presence." So there was no one with Joseph when he made himself known to his brothers. And he wept so loudly that the Egyptians heard him, and Pharaoh's household heard about it. And Joseph said to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Is my father still living?" But his brothers were not able to answer him because they were terrified at his presence. And then Joseph said to his brothers, "Come close to me." And when they had done so, he said, "I am your brother Joseph, the one you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed and do not be angry with yourself for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you." Verse 14. Then he threw his arms around his brother Benjamin and he wept. And Benjamin embraced him weeping, and he kissed all his brothers and wept over them. Afterwards, his brothers talked with him. You kind of have to see it before it begins to make sense. If you search through the tattered pages of the biography of Joseph, Genesis 37 to 50, you'll notice that the biography always seems to fall open at this one place. This hurtful place, a well-worn bookmark is left there. It was where 10 brothers did a dirty deed to a 17-year-old kid. It was a terrible thing. And that's probably why we keep going back to it. That's how it usually goes with terrible things. We go back and we revisit them and we ruminate about them and we think about it. It's a long time ago, but it doesn't matter. Just about every time you lay this biography of Joseph down, it opens up to this page. Hurts always have a backstory. The backstory for Joseph looks like this. He's 17 years old when his brothers sell him into slavery. Trafficked, that's the word. Trafficked into slavery at a time when human trafficking would have been not only common, but to many cultures, very acceptable. From that time of being a slave, he then ended up as a prisoner because of some unfortuitous events. But after a while, he actually is noble in his behavior and he earns his freedom. But it's been 13 years in a very sour place, all because of what some brothers did when you were 17. By the time he's 30, he gets to enter into Pharaoh's court by some surprising and only, of course, supernatural events. He has several prosperous years in his life. He gets married. He has a couple of sons. I love the name of his sons. They're the kind of names that express chances to begin again and the new freedom of opportunity, refreshment to his life. He names his boys my second chance, in a sense. By the time he's 37 years of age, he's gone through 7 years of prosperity, but now is going to begin 7 years of famine. It's a very key role because he's been placed in Pharaoh's authority under responsibility for food distribution during the famine to keep the people of Egypt fed. And so by the time that we get to chapter 45 in verse 6, we're actually 2 years into this famine. That makes Joseph 39 years old. When the events happen that we're about to describe. Do the math. That's 22 years since that awful day in a shepherd's field. You'd think that 22 years is enough to forget hard things that happen in your life, right? You got anything in your life that you've been remembering for 22 years? We're catching up with Joseph's brothers today. We find them on a second trip to the grocery store, so to speak. A 250-mile journey from Canaan to Egypt, all for the sake of buying food. Crops are not growing in Canaan. The famine has been overwhelming. No rain in sight. It's not been a drop of rain that has fallen to the ground in 2 years. No planting, no harvesting. There's not a lot of option. The only place it has food is Egypt. And though these brothers are indeed hungry, they are extremely reluctant to make this second trip to Egypt. See, when 10 sons of Jacob made their first trip to the grocery store, things didn't go very well. Only 9 of the brothers came home. They had to leave Simeon behind in Egypt because the vice regent of the land held suspicion for them. He accused them of being spies. And 10 brothers tried very hard to convince them that they were indeed honest men. But for some reason, it was a really hard sell. The vice regent of Egypt is Joseph. 10 brothers don't know that on this first trip. He's questioning them. Joseph recognizes their hungry faces. He's having a hard time believing that they are indeed honest men. He's watched them lie before. He's been the butt of their jokes, their lies, their brutality. But now they were bowing before him and they were begging for food and they were all saying, "We're really good guys. You can trust us." Joseph did give them food on that first trip. But not before he made deep inquiry about their life and his father. And in that inquiry, he learns that he actually has a new little brother that he's never met. A boy by the name of Benjamin. And there's something special about Benjamin. He's the only brother among all those 12 sons that's a full brother to Joseph. See, Joseph was from a very dysfunctional family. A lot of families are dysfunctional. And a lot of hurt in life comes, it shows up because of dysfunctional families. It did for Joseph. Back in the days when Jacob, his father, was still called the chiseler or the manipulator or the liar. Pick a name. That was him, his dad. A lot of challenging things happen. The main source of dysfunction in that family is that this man had children from several different women, 4. Now, at least he had the decency or the integrity or whatever it was to take care of all the people he brought into the world. But it was no easy deal. His real wife's name was Rachel, and she is the mother to Joseph and Benjamin. All the rest of the brothers are half-brothers, and that explains why Joseph is so interested in meeting his younger brother when he learns he's been born. So Joseph, vice regent of Egypt, he forces the 10 sons of Jacob who had come for groceries into an arrangement. In order that I know that you are indeed honest men, I want to see your youngest brother. Bring him to me. And one of you will stay here with me in Egypt until I see that young boy's face. 10 sons of Jacob went to Egypt to buy food. Only 9 sons came home. You can imagine what that does to a father who's already lost one son. It may have been 20 years ago, but I'm telling you, a dad still feels it. When a dad loses a child, he feels it. I don't care how many decades you put in distance, a dad feels the loss of his boy. Back on that day, 20 years or more before, brothers came home from a shepherd's field trying to explain the mystery of a bloody coat. And a dad just sits there with that blood-soaked coat in his hands, wondering what happened to his boy. Great sorrow to a father, and he remembers. First it was Joseph, and now it's Simeon. You left Simeon behind in Egypt. And then when the 9 boys do get back, they tell their father that it's going to be necessary to take Benjamin with them down to Egypt too. Jacob says, no way. Chapter 42, verse 36 says, you have deprived me of my children. Joseph is no more. Simeon is no more. Now you want to take Benjamin? Everything is against me. I don't blame him for his reluctance. It's not until the food supply dwindles down to nothing and he has no more choices that a father named Jacob has to make a deliberate choice. You boys are going to have to go to the grocery store again. And I know when you go ask the vice regent for food, you'll have to show him Benjamin's face. To Jacob, there were very few selections left. 10 more sons now leave for Egypt. The 9 who made the trip before and 1 young son named Benjamin. It's going to be the first time that all 12 of Jacob's boys end up in the same room. There are 10 who are coming from Canaan. There were Simeon who's left behind in Egypt. And there's Joseph, the one who has the power to crush them all. For those of us on the outside looking in, there's one question that overshadows this troubled family reunion. It's this. Did it ever enter Joseph's mind that maybe these are not the same 10 guys who lost their head out in a shepherd's field many years ago? We're about to find out. Chapter 44 begins. 10 sons have arrived in Egypt to make another appeal to Joseph. He returns their brother Simeon to them, and then he invites them to supper at the palace. It was a rather unique supper. All the Hebrews sat at one table. Joseph sat at the other table. According to Egyptian law, maybe it's tradition, I can't quite tell how serious this was, but Hebrews would not eat or dine with Egyptians. It wouldn't happen. Joseph is off at his own table watching the behavior of his brothers. Joseph asks the steward of his house to serve the meal in a rather unusual way. He says, go to all the brothers, give them a liberal portion of the royal meat, but to Benjamin, you give him a double portion. And they do. They begin to heap the piles of food on young Benjamin's plate. Oh, he can't eat it all, but that's not the point. Joseph wants to see what his brothers are going to do. 11 sons of Jacob sitting at one table, gorging themselves, scratching their heads, uncertain what this means. Joseph sitting at another table, watching their every move. After supper, their bellies are full. They burp a little. They loosen their belts. They're satisfied. And Joseph sends them on their way. Now Joseph gave these instructions to the steward of the house. Fill the men's sacks with as much food as they can carry, and put each man's silver up in the mouth of the sack. Then put my cup, the silver one, in the mouth of the youngest one, that's Benjamin, put it in his sack, along with the silver for his grain. And the steward did as Joseph said. Look what Joseph has accomplished here. He filled their sacks with food. He put the silver that they had brought as payment back in their purses. In other words, he gave them the food for free. In addition, Joseph put his own silver drinking cup in the sack of young Benjamin. What's going on here? Joseph is out to thrust his 11 brothers into a totally unjust situation in order to determine what kind of men they are today. As morning dawned, the text says, the men, all 11, were sent on their way with their donkeys. They'd not gone far from the city when Joseph said to his steward, go after the men at once. And when you catch up with them, say to them, why have you repaid good with evil? Isn't this the cup my master drinks from or uses for divination? This is a wicked thing you have done. Within a minute, the Egyptian cavalry is all lined up, chasing them out to retrieve the brothers, and all 11 of them arrive back at the palace with a look of panic on their face. You can read it in their eyes. We didn't do anything wrong. And the young boy, he wouldn't take your cup. He wouldn't. We're honest men. Are they? Now, the steward who came from Joseph's palace, he was assigned only to return with the man who had the cup in his possession. That would be Benjamin. He was only supposed to bring Benjamin back, and yet all the brothers decide to return to the palace. I suppose Joseph is seeing if the brothers would dump Benjamin like they have dumped Joseph so many years ago. Perhaps to his surprise, all the brothers return to the palace, all ready to protect Benjamin, all ready to guard the welfare of their father and their family. And now remember, the question of the hour. Did it ever enter Joseph's mind that maybe these are not the same guys who lost their heads out in a shepherd's field 22 years ago? Is it possible that the men in front of him are not the same vicious, lying men he knew before? Judah, one of the brothers, he decides to be the spokesman. You find his words starting in verse 27. He comes clean. He talks about what our father told us before we left. He gave us these instructions. Your servant, my father, said to us, you know that my wife bore me two sons. One of them went away from me, and I said, he has surely been torn to pieces. I've not seen him since. And if you take this one from me, too, and harm comes to him, you'll bring my gray head down to the grave in misery. Judah is still speaking. So now, if the boy is not with us, when I go back to your servant, my father, and if my father, whose life is closely bound up with the boy's life, sees the boy isn't there, he'll kill him. Your servant, I, Judah, will bring the gray head of our father down to the grave in sorrow. I, your servant, I guaranteed, Judah said, the boy's safety to my father. I said, if I do not bring him back to you, I will bear the blame before you, my father, all my life. Now then, please, let your servant, let me, Judah says, remain. Let me stay here. I'll be your Lord's slave in place of the boy, and let the boy return with his brothers. How can I go back to my father if the boy's not with me? No! Do not let me see this misery that would come upon my father. And there it is. There was a day in the life of Judah when he didn't care about his father's pain. He didn't care about what happened to a brother. All he cared about was his own experience and his own desires. And anybody who got in the way of that would be eliminated. That was Judah. But after 22 years of witnessing the grief of his father, he can't do it anymore. And he wants no further part of sorrow. I'll stay here myself rather than bring this pain on my dad. Somewhere there is a Father's Day story in there with deep richness. You know, sometimes, after the passing of time, that person that hurt you is the very same scoundrel they were before. But sometimes, life has seasoned them, and they aren't anything of their former self. And the question is, will you allow for their growth. It's part of the questions of forgiveness. Then Joseph could no longer control himself before all of his attendants. And he cried out, "Have everybody leave the room." There was no one with Joseph when he made himself known to his brothers. And he wept so loudly, all the Egyptians heard about it, all Pharaoh's house heard about it. They were hearing this, stunned at what was going on with the vice regent. Joseph said to his brothers, I am Joseph. Is my father still alive? His brothers were not able to answer him because they were terrified at his presence. And then Joseph said to his brothers, come close. And when they had done that, he said, I am your brother Joseph, who you sold into Egypt. Now, do not be distressed. Do not be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you. For 2 years now, there's been a famine in the land. For the next 5 years, there will be no plowing or reaping, but God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to save your lives as a great inheritance. Together we are experiencing, we're witnessing forgiveness in its richest form. That's what it looks like, forgiveness, for a 39-year-old man with a 22-year-old hurt. How do I know when I've truly forgiven someone? Well, in that story, there are five signals. The first begins here. Number one, the first signal, you stop telling people about your hurt and the one who hurt you. In chapter 45, verse 1, Joseph said, have everyone leave my presence. Nobody in Egypt needs to know or see what goes on here. This is a matter for our family. See, all the Egyptians would have been on Joseph's side. They would have rallied support. They could have gathered a mob to do damage to these people who hurt him so bad. But he says, you know what? Get everybody out of here. Nobody in Egypt needs to know. That's a powerful principle for our own forgiveness. You are beginning to forgive someone when you stop bringing other people in on the issue. When you stop spreading it out. Forgiveness is to stop telling other people. Send them all out of the room. Deal with the hurt in the presence of only those who own it. That's the first signal. There's a second signal. How do I know if I've forgiven someone? The second signal is this. You do not allow others to be afraid or intimidated by you. When Joseph revealed himself to his brothers, they were terrified, and rightly so. He had the power to behead them in a moment. But immediately he takes their fear away and he invites them to come close. He had no intention of dealing with them in intimidation or the expressions of power. He would deal with them as brothers, not subjects. You know, when you have someone in your life who has hurt you, it's kind of a way that you have something on them. And what you have on them is kind of played out in family reunions or in kitchen tables or conversations at work. You have something on them because of a hurt that's there. And we often play these games, wanting to intimidate and bring fear. But instead of playing a game of power, Joseph was capable of playing. He forfeited that power and he said, you are free to come close to me. It was a signal of his forgiveness. There's a third signal you should notice. You want them to release themselves and not feel guilty. Maybe that's the most powerful portion of the text that we read. Verse 5 said, and now do not be distressed. Do not be angry with yourselves for selling me here. Because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you. Joseph has the life seasoning or the maturity to recognize that God's plan has been far more significant than the plan of dishonorable brothers. He noticed that God could use the bad and bring out the good. And so his encouragement to his brothers was to help them see that God has brought a far bigger picture into play. He could have allowed them or caused them simply to ruminate about what happened in an old page a long time ago. But he says it's a bigger story to be told here. It's a great facet of healing for God's people. Most folks continue for years to focus on one bad event, but there's a lot more going on in life than the bad event. What's God doing? What's God doing in his healing for this new time in your experience? Paul wrote in Romans chapter 8, verse 28, and we know that in all things God works for good to those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. Forgiveness has to do with allowing God's larger plan to be engaged among these people. See this through the eyes of faith. And when you're willing to let God's larger plan tell the story, when you're willing to let the enemy in on God's larger plan, those are the moments of the beginnings of forgiveness. God's got a bigger story to tell than just that moment of sorrow. There's a fourth signal that should be seen. This is a lifelong commitment. In the life of Joseph, the next scene that plays out is his adjustments based on his forgiveness. He played this out by moving his family from Canaan down to Egypt. He gives them provision, property, homestead, safety. His personal release came as he was seeking to enrich those who had once hurt him, and God was blessing that action to extreme degrees. Forgiveness is of no value when once you have been softened in heart to grant forgiveness, but then you choose to harden it again. I promise you, the second hardness will be more rigid even than the first. Your likelihood of recovery from a second hardness is very slim. Godly forgiveness closes the book. It ends the chapter. It's part of the lifelong experience to try it again, to tell God's larger story. Forgiveness is a lifelong expression. Signal number five is, I will pray for them to be blessed. Number five is the crowning jewel of the process of forgiveness. When I've actually brought myself to the place where I am praying, asking God for their good welfare, pleading their case before the Lord, I know that I have fully released the burden of hurt and forgiveness and accomplished the supernatural work of forgiveness when I've been praying that God would bless them. Norman Moss, author, was defining some of his own observation in The Power of Forgiveness. He wrote this. He said, forgiveness is powerful for your enemy, and it is powerful for you. To play out that story, he records this event. There was a woman who had been in a car accident 22 years ago. Her neck had been in constant pain, her shoulder stiff for all of these years, so much so that she was unable to turn her head and therefore actually could no longer drive, lost her license because of her limitations. She had substantial independence taken from her. One time there was a lady asked her this. She said, have you ever prayed for the driver that caused that accident? No, was her reply. So her friend suggested, I suggest that you begin to pray for him. So she did. She said, I forgive him. I forgive him. Then her friend said, have you ever prayed for him to be blessed? For God to actually bring blessing into the life of the man that caused that accident? She said, no. She said, I suggest you begin to ask God to intervene to bless this man's life. The woman took the challenge to bless the man. And what she strangely began to find is that the pain was leaving her own body, her own neck and shoulders. They loosened up unexplainably. Before long, she could move her neck, and for the first time in 24 years, healing increased. Her prayers of forgiveness and blessing increased. What a surprise. Releasing another releases us. Could it be possible? Another account from Norman Moss involved a lady in her 40s whose father had been terribly abusive to her. This lady claimed, she said, I've forgiven my dad. I've forgiven him again and again. But despite her prayer, she always had this incredible heaviness in her spirit about her dad. And then she was challenged. Begin asking God to bless your father. Speak out loud blessing in prayer on your dad. And strangely, what she began to notice is that as she tried to bless her father, the heaviness began to leave and ultimately completely left. Her own testimony is this. She knows the heaviness completely gone. And by her own words, her life has been changed because of that release. Releasing another releases us. Do you suppose it's possible? Forgiveness is not total forgiveness until we bless our enemies, pray for them to be blessed. Jesus said, love your enemies, pray for those who persecute you. It is a part of the release that you grant to them and the release that you receive of your own. To release someone totally is achieved when we set God free to bless them. And in this we are first blessed, and those who totally forgive are indeed blessed the most. You know, during this series, we've been invited to take an extreme opportunity to forgive. God has drawn you unto himself by an extraordinary action. And God calls us to forgive as he has forgiven us. God sees these children here in process, in the progress of movement in their lives toward the kind of children that could bring joy to their father. And perhaps these are some of the pictures of what total forgiveness really is. You sort of have to see it before it makes sense. I pray that God is opening to you such new vision today. Let's bow together as we pray. Heavenly Father, in these moments around your word, we notice that you have been extreme in love toward us, and that grace is wide and rich to have covered all of our sin. And no matter how many times we have hurt you and disgraced you as our Father, your arms remain open to embrace us and invite us to come near. God, I ask that the wonder of such richness would express itself in our own lives, the relationships of our families, and odd things that have happened. Would you bring healing and forgiveness in powerful ways in the settings of our own lives? Through Jesus Christ we pray. Amen.